Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. On this week's programme, my guest is Dr. Kevin Williams, who recently retired from his position as Senior Lecturer in Mater Dei Institute of Education. He is also a former President of the Educational Studies Association of Ireland and a Research Fellow at the Irish Centre for Poetry Studies. Most of his work is in the philosophy of education, and he's particularly interested in religion, secularism and citizenship, and he has published widely in these areas. When I met with Kevin Williams, we had a wide-ranging discussion about teaching, change in education, junior cert reform, about the performance of recent ministers for education, and about the ethos of schools. I'm going to bring you the conversation over two programmes, this week and next. In this first instalment of the interview, my opening question to Kevin was, how well do schools today meet the needs of society?
I think they meet the needs of society fairly well, and I think they meet the needs of society fairly well because they meet the needs of the children fairly well. And I often get impatient with critics of schools and critics of teachers who olagone about things that they don't do or deficiencies in teaching. I'm not such a fool as to claim that they're doing everything perfectly, but I've had the privilege when I worked in teacher education of being in dozens and dozens of schools, particularly in the Greater Dublin area, but also in Galway and the Connacht area. And I never cease to be impressed by what's going on in schools. Going on in schools, both at the kind of macro level of the buzz, the extracurricular activities, the things that the kids are engaged in. And I am also impressed by what I see in the classroom. I'm impressed by what the teachers are succeeding in doing with the children. And I'm impressed by the kind of the liveliness and good humour and willingness to work, to learn, to be challenged of young people.
So you're somebody who is happy with what the education system is doing?
Well, I'm not saying that the education system is perfect. That would be foolish. But yes, and I wish maybe when I have a bit more space, maybe I'll sit back and be able to write about my impressions of what's going on in school, because normally I'm taking a retirement package now from the day job and I'm doing other work now, but at this time of the year, for the month of January, I would normally spend it going around to schools in the Leinster area. And I just love the work. I love the work because I loved what I saw going on in schools. And I'm not saying that the kids don't get bored by some things and dissatisfied by some things. And I'm not saying that, of course, there are troubled children there. And but that's not the fault of the teachers or of the system. I do think it's reprehensible, though, that middle management support in schools has been withdrawn, particularly under the Minister Quinn, and guidance counselling as well. I think that's such an important intervention for young people who are troubled. I think teachers do a good job in supporting children, but at the same time, teachers are busy people. Like, anybody who knows schools knows how busy it is for teachers. You go from one class to the other. You don't have any space. You don't have space to draw your breath. And at the end, we say at 4 o'clock or 4:10, all right, maybe they could see children there. But for most teachers, at the end of the school day, they are really drained and tired. And they don't themselves have the energy, the resources to support children who are in trouble, as I'm sure they would like to.
You've said that you've recently taken a retirement package and you used to work in Mater Dei Institute of Education. How has teaching changed over the time you've been observing it and doing it?
You see, I think people can have an exaggerated idea of how things change, because I am a philosopher by trade and training, and I also have a background in French as well, because my degree is in French. And when I look at texts from the 19th century about the way pupils behave in school, now I'm talking now here particularly about Charlotte Bronte's and Anne Bronte's novels, you just look at the way young people were there. They were nasty, they were provocative, they were difficult, they were sneering. What's so different about that from the way people are nowadays. Now that's like a kind of, if you like, an historical perspective. And then if you're to look at, we'll say, just look at my own experience. I taught for some years in Ballymun Comprehensive. Like, there were some challenging kids there, and there were some difficult and trying situations. But people, that's nearly 30 years ago now. And what's different from the way it was then, from the way it's supposed to be nowadays? Like, there are difficult and trying situations. There are difficult and trying pupils. They were there 30 years ago. They were there 130 years ago. They've always been there. And but having said that, I think for the most part, what goes on in schools is positive. At the same time, you have to make a distinction here between teachers, we'll say, who are working in schools where the young people value learning, and they value like the positional advantage it might confer. That is, that they value exam results. Like, those teachers in those kind of environments are under particular pressure. But like, children are teachers are in schools where they're doing their best to hold on, to keep them in school, to get them the minimum examination results possible. They're under other pressures, but they're not the same pressures as those, that the results pressures you get in the more middle class schools.
And how do you think the system then works, either in conjunction with or against what teachers are doing, in terms of the overall outcomes of education? I suppose what I have in mind, Kevin, is the fact that students are expected to perform in a relatively narrow exam called the Leaving Certificate, and that teachers are trying to operate and trying to help students prepare for that. And I'm wondering, how does that work in conjunction with the good work that you see happening in the schools you visit?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the biggest myths in Irish education, that there's a necessary conflict between preparing people for examinations and supporting them and attending to their personal education. That's a great myth. And I think that there's no necessary inconsistency between the two of them. Teaching them well and minding them go together. And if I had a choice between a teacher who was full of old bunkum and twaddle about the whole person and supporting the whole person, and you get loads of people making those kind of claims and those kind of affirmations, and a teacher who carefully corrects pupils' work, I think it's far more, I think it's a great form of support to young people to correct their work. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with correcting their work, and I think it's the proper job of teachers is to correct work and to support their pupils in their kind of academic endeavours. And I think that is part of general education, the general education of young people in doing that. And I think it's a cop-out to say that it's not, and that we need to have a broader view of education. Yes, it's important to have a broader view of education, but it's also important to do the job.
Ireland is changing in terms of this a greater multicultural population in the country, and technology is proliferating. How do you think schools need to respond to those kinds of changes?
I'm a bit sceptical of all this talk about Ireland changing. Now, first of all, there are only about 10% of pupils are kind of non-traditional Irish. That's a fairly small proportion, and they tend to be concentrated in particular schools. So to hear people talking, you think there were huge numbers. You think it was like some of the suburbs of France, or Paris, I should say. But it's not like that in reality. Like, the schools are still predominantly monoethnically Irish. So I don't think the change is all that great. That's number one. Number two, I think people exaggerate the challenge of multi-ethnic schooling. And I think people have lost the sight of the importance of the difference in social class. And let me give you an example. A few short years ago, I was in a school in, we'll say, the scampi belt of South Dublin. And the pupils were very committed to learning. I got great exam results and all that. And there were several non-Irish in the class, and they were obviously non-Irish, and I was supervising a lesson in religion, and these children weren't doing religion, and there was no problem, they just didn't participate. Anyway, after the lesson, they got off and they all moved out of the classroom with their pals, and there was no kind of distinction between them. They were rich kids, though. Like, you could see it. It was a school, a fee charging school. All rich kids together were very comfortable with one another. That afternoon, I went to a school up in an area of great deprivation, and there was a huge difference in the kind of life experiences and the school experiences of the children in the scampi belt school and in the school of social disadvantage.
What's that term, scampi belt? I'm not familiar with that.
Like the rich schools, they used to use it with regard to the Labour Party, like the Labour Party was really full of people who were scampi eaters or something. And so we said that the well-to-do schools in the Dublin 4 and South County Dublin area. But there's a greater difference, as I think, between children of the poor and children of the rich, no matter what their ethnic background. I think ethnic background is less important than relative poverty.
And what kind of a job do you think teachers and education in general is doing to address poverty and to meet the needs of students who are impoverished financially?
Yeah, impoverished financially, and I suppose culturally as well. We wouldn't want to kind of underestimate that too. Like some of them would come from backgrounds where education isn't valued in the same way, and where maybe the parents themselves are unemployed. But I've had the privilege of being in many, many schools in areas of great disadvantage. And I'm just humbled by what I see of what the teachers do and how they connect with these young people. And I'm going to just give an example. And I was in a school in an area of disadvantage, and this is about 5 or 6 years ago. And I was probably there on a Wednesday, and on Tuesday, the Irish Times had a feature on boxing as a sport in the school. It's in Clochgulig, and the teacher who ran it is a guy called Joe Varley. So when I went into the school, supervised a few lessons there, met some of the kids who were involved in the boxing, met Joe Varley himself, and I was just humbled by the kind of commitment that the school showed, the kids showed, and to the fact that, like, the school for those children was an oasis of enrichment, of care, which perhaps they may not have experienced in their own background. And what I see in the schools in schools in poor areas is I see very committed teachers, and it's a privilege.
One of the priorities for the government at the moment is junior cert reform. What are your views about those efforts to reform the junior cert?
I always had a suspicion that it was driven by a concern with money, and it was driven with a concern to save money. Now, I have no problem with that. Like, if the government would come out and say, we want to save money, we're going to abolish the junior cert, fine, let's be honest about it. But I think it's wrapped up in all this what I call a compendium of cliches about self-directed agents and agents of change and all that. I think that's all bunkum. I think most of the rhetoric in the document supporting the new junior certificate is rhetoric, and windy rhetoric. That's what I think of that, and I'm just uneasy about removing the kind of external exams. I do think, though, that the current Minister for Education is a very sensible woman. She's very unideological in that sense, and I think she has given a very good compromise to the teachers. And the 60-40 compromise seems to me to be a good one. And I think it's great that pupils are going to get a state certificate, because, you see, sometimes people think, oh, they're all trying to get points and they're all trying to get into medicine. That's not true at all. Only 8% of kids get over 500 points. So it's a small number. And there are about 20% of children who don't go into junior cycle.
Don't go into senior cycle.
Oh, don't go into senior cycle, yeah. And they need certification. And the certification that is most credible in the eyes of the outside world is state certification. And full credit to Minister John O'Sullivan, who is retaining that. And I think that's admirable. I think it would be very salutary to examine the status of two types of assessment in Irish education. And they are assessment at the end of primary school. And what we will find, we have school-based assessment at the end of primary schools. And what we have, according to the research, this is just not my impression, is that the portfolios of achievement which are drawn up by primary schools at the primary teachers at the end of primary schooling have little purchase in secondary school. And I am told by people who've researched that they're very often not even looked at when they go into secondary school. So I think that's a kind of a window into how school-based assessment is actually perceived in the real world. Another area where we have school-based assessment to beat the band is the transition year. And I would say that the purchase of school certificates in the transition year outside of schools is zero. Again, more school-based certificate, which is certification, which is disregarded.
You said that a lot of the reform efforts at the junior cert level are rhetoric, but I suppose what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, look, there are some core skills that graduates of the system or of the programme need, and let's try and break down the subject barriers and have, you know, have greater integration between the different subjects. Is that not more appropriate for the future that these students are going to be growing up in, where maybe the jobs they'll be doing are not even known about already?
I think there's a lot of nonsense spoken about that as well. Obviously, I think the business of schools is to teach the core skills. It has always been the business of schools to teach the core skills, particularly the enabling skills of literacy and numeracy. That, like, there it's kind of primary task, and people will say, oh, it's too much about books and numbers. Well, that's what schools are primarily about. They're about books and numbers. I don't think that we can quarrel with that. And I think those enabling skills are vital in any kind of future, any economy. Literacy and numeracy are vital. And it's very interesting that recently I've been rereading statistical evidence that in longitudinal surveys of in the United Kingdom over the last 50 years, that pupils who did best at maths were the highest earners 15, 20, 30 years after they left school. So there's a high correlation between doing well at maths and earning more money. The next important area is general literacy. So let's not have all this old guff about self-directed learners and all that. That's all very fine, but literacy and numeracy are at the heart of things. And as well, I think this thing about subject barriers, a lot of nonsense is spoken about that. That's been going around since I was a student in the 1970s. But I still think that we need to be able to focus on the actual subjects and the subjects with traditions of learning and roots in the life of the community. Let's take history, for example. That former Minister Quinn said, oh, it's up to teachers to justify why you should teach history. I just think that's incredibly ignorant. I mean, that's like saying it's up to doctors to justify why you should cure patients. Of course you have to have you have to have history. You have to have history to know yourself, to know your country, to know where you've come from. Of course, to say that you can dispense with history and make it an optional subject would lead to a great impoverishment of young people's experience. And likewise, I would say as well with geography. So there are loads of things people need to know to kind of make their way in the world, to make their way successfully in the world. And those kind of items of basic knowledge are to be found in traditional school subjects as well as in, of course, literacy and numeracy, which I put on a different plane because they're enabling skills.
But it's one of the problems with education that we keep on piling on more and more subjects, and we've now got a situation where teachers are just battling with an overcrowded curriculum. So maybe something has to go. And maybe that's what Rory Quinn was trying to get at when he said teachers have to justify history. Like, how do teachers find room to accommodate all the important things that students need to know? How do they prioritise what to do?
Well, it's difficult. I know it's difficult to prioritise, but I think at the same time there is a kind of, if you like, a benchmark for prioritising what we should do, and that's in a way, we should look very carefully at what we have traditionally done. If you look, for instance, at the at second level, we had a document called Rules and Programmes for Secondary Schools, and they define in very narrow terms, and very narrow areas that pupils actually had to do. I've no problem with doing less and doing it better. And like originally, the Rules and Programme for Secondary Schools did expect people to do less. And I know schools heaped on more and more things. What we have traditionally demanded of schools has not been very extensive with regard to subjects.
But isn't that changing with things like, say, for example, CPSE at post-primary and SPHE at primary and, I suppose, science being introduced to primary schools, things like that, that teachers are expected to do more?
I suppose, well, that's okay. That's probably true. But CSPE has been in since 1967 it came in as civics and it was compulsory. In 1996 it came in as CSPE, so it's there now, some 20 years as a compulsory subject. Doesn't take up very much time of the curriculum, and I that 70 hours per annum, and I think that's perfectly legitimate, as indeed is SPHE and RSE, which have to be taught at second level as well.
You seem to say that we should really be guided by tradition in terms of what we do in schools. So do you think there's any need for change at all? Or how should change, if it should come about in school, in education, how should it happen?
Oh, no, I think we should be guided by tradition and look very carefully at our tradition and know our tradition before we add things on. And I think it's absolutely, totally appropriate that in the last 30 years, we have added on our relationships and sexuality education. Obviously, that's a crucial thing for young people to be apprised of, to learn and to know. And if they don't do it in school, there's a danger that they won't learn it at all, and their parents will be too embarrassed to teach them, and people will just pick up wrong information from the street. I think that's been a marvellous change over the last 20 years in particular, where that has become a compulsory element in schooling, and I salute that. That's where I think we've quite rightly developed our tradition to incorporate something that was notoriously absent.
And in general, how should change come about then? Should it be, say, from the minister? Should it be from the, like for example, like what do you think of, say, a partnership like the NCCA, which consults with parent bodies, teaching bodies, union bodies, and so on, and tries to bring about change that way as a model of change? What would be your view of that?
In fairness, I'd have to say the NCCA does endeavour to be representative. However, I tell you, if I were Minister for Education or if I had any say in the matter, do you know who I would turn to? I would turn to teachers themselves. You might say, well, look, that's a very amorphous bunch of people. But there is there are several groups of marvellously professionally organised teachers, and they're the subject associations. And I am just dismayed at the fact that they don't get the kind of profile that they deserve. They are made up of very committed teachers who give loads of voluntary time to improving their own teaching skills and subsequently the education experiences of their children. And before I'd do anything of this nonsense about trying to create what self-directed agents of change, I would go to the teacher associations and find out what they think. Now, I know you might say to me, Sean, teachers associations are going to have a vested interest. Of course they'd have a vested interest. They'd have a vested interest in history, or they'd have a vested interest in geography or in English. But I would go and find out what they think. Change should be driven by the practitioners more than anybody else, not by IBEC or any of these people who don't actually sit in the classroom. And I think the subject associations are a marvellous conduit into what committed professional teachers really think and do.
Is there not a danger that could become very inward looking? That maybe, say, by having somebody like IBEC involved, it can kind of help be attuned to what's happening in the broader society in terms of the needs of graduates from the system?
What you'll find out coming out over and over again, top of the list, literacy and numeracy. So in spite of all the guff that we hear from IBEC representatives, literacy and numeracy come in very, very high indeed. And of course, there are other qualities as well. Like there's willing, now these are not skills, these are personal qualities. There's a distinction that people commonly miss, is willingness to work hard, willingness to learn on the job. These things are important as well. But in terms of what schools can do, I think literacy and numeracy must be kind of up there very high. Added to that is, of course, the development of young people's confidence, because I think that's important as well when it comes to the world of work. And I think schools over the generations have done their best to enhance young people's confidence, particularly via extracurricular activities. Regrettably, though, I do think there's been perhaps too much of an emphasis on competitive team sports, and it's kind of dismaying to read every spring the emphasis that's put on particular schools' rugby. I think that is not a healthy development. That's obsessive. And when people give out about the point system, I can understand their concerns, but I think they're completely exaggerated. But I think we need to kind of take to task this kind of obsession with schools rugby. And look, there are other sports as well, but I think schools rugby is perhaps the worst of all.
And going back to the IBEC argument, do you think we do enough to encourage students to be risk takers and to be entrepreneurial?
Yeah, but you see, Sean, this is where people are cracked. They're school pupils. We're talking about schools. We're not talking about, we'll say, universities or DITs. We're talking about schools. And in schools, the remit of schools is primarily with the enabling skills of literacy and numeracy. However, again, this is something where I think people who sound off about the system don't know enough about it. There are at least three areas within the school system where this is very, very strongly promoted. One, the transition year and many companies and things like that. Two, the Leaving Cert, the LCA, the Leaving Cert Applied. Huge element in the Leaving Cert Applied. Of course, people talk about it, they forget about the Leaving Cert Applied, because the people who talk about the school system are mostly middle class people talking about middle class children, and only 8% of people do the Leaving Cert Applied. The irony, I'd like the listeners to be aware of this, 8% do the Leaving Cert Applied, 8% get over 500 points. So the Leaving Cert Applied has a huge emphasis on entrepreneurial skills. Into the bargain, we have the Leaving Certificate Vocational, the link modules. We have it there, but it's not there for everyone. And because for the most part, young people who want to get into high prestige, courses certainly wouldn't be doing the Leaving Cert Applied, and they wouldn't be doing the link modules and the Leaving Certificate Vocational. And in one essay which came out in the new edition there yesterday, called Education Matters, edited by James Norman, I take the example of the Leaving Cert Applied and say, can you imagine the difference it would make to the education system at senior cycle if only those who did a Leaving Cert Applied could get into medicine? Like, that would really change the whole climate with regard to the high points and everything like that. But that's not likely to happen.
An interesting question there from Dr. Kevin Williams, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to my guest this week, Kevin Williams, for his time. The second part of my conversation with Kevin Williams was on the topic of school ethos, and I'll bring you that on next week's programme. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.